Chapter 63. Esther's narrative. We came home from Mr. Boythorn's after 6 pleasant weeks. We were often in the park, and in the woods, and seldom past the lodge, where we had taken shelter without looking in to speak to the keeper's wife. But we saw no more of Lady Dedlock, except at church on Sundays. There was company at Chesney Wold, and although several beautiful faces surrounded her, her face retained the same influence on me as at first. I do not quite know even now, whether it was painful or pleasurable, whether it drew me towards her, or made me shrink from her. I think I admired her with a kind of fear, and I know that in her presence my thoughts always wandered back, as they had done at first, to that old time of my life. I had a fancy, on more than one of these Sundays, that what this lady so curiously was to me, I was to her. I mean that I disturbed her thoughts as she influenced mine, though in some different way. But when I stole a glance at her, and saw her so composed, and distant and unapproachable, I felt this to be a foolish weakness. Indeed, I felt the whole state of my mind in reference to her to be weak and unreasonable, and I remonstrated with myself about it as much as I could. One incident that occurred, before we quitted Mr. Boythorn's house, I had better mention in this place. I was walking in the garden with Ada, and when I was told that someone wished to see me. Going into the breakfast room, where this person was waiting, I found it to be the French maid who had cast off her shoes, and walked through the wet grass on the day when it thundered and lightened. "Mademoiselle," she began, looking fixedly at me with her two eager eyes, though otherwise presenting an agreeable appearance and speaking neither with boldness nor servility, "I have taken a great liberty in coming here, but you know how to excuse it. Being so amiable, mademoiselle." "No excuse is necessary," I returned, "if you wish to speak to me." "That is my desire, mademoiselle. 1,000 thanks for the permission. I have your leave to speak. Is it not?" she said in a quick, natural way. "Certainly," said one. "Mademoiselle, you are so amiable. Listen then, if you please. I have left my lady. We could not agree. My lady is so high, so very high. Pardon. Mademoiselle, you are right." Her quickness anticipated what I might have said presently, but as yet had only thought. "It is not for me to come here to complain of my lady. But I say she is so high, so very high. I will not say a word more. All the world knows that." "Go on, if you please," said one. "Assuredly. Mademoiselle, I am thankful for your politeness. Mademoiselle, I have an inexpressible desire to find service with a young lady who is good, accomplished, beautiful. You are good, accomplished, and beautiful as an angel. Ah, could I have the honor of being your domestic?" "I am sorry," I began. "Do not dismiss me so soon, mademoiselle," she said with an involuntary contraction of her fine black eyebrows. "Let me hope a moment. Mademoiselle, I know this service would be more retired than that which I have quitted." "Well, I wish that. I know this service would be less distinguished than that which I have quitted." "Well, I wish that. I know that I should win less, as to wages here." "Good. I am content. I assure you," said I, quite embarrassed by the mere idea of having such an attendant, "that I keep no maid." "Ah, mademoiselle, but why not? Why not, when you can have one so devoted to you? Who would be enchanted to serve you? Who would be so true, so zealous, and so faithful every day? Mademoiselle, I wish with all my heart to serve you. Do not speak of money at present. Take me as I am. For nothing." She was so singularly earnest that I drew back, almost afraid of her. Without appearing to notice it, in her ardor she still pressed herself upon me, speaking in a rapid, subdued voice, though always with a certain grace and propriety. "Mademoiselle, I come from the South Country, where we are quick, and where we like and dislike very strong. My lady was too high for me, I was too high for her. It is done past finished. Receive me as your domestic, and I will serve you well. I will do more for you than you figure to yourself now. Chut. Mademoiselle, I will no matter, I will do my utmost possible in all things. If you accept my service, you will not repent it. Mademoiselle, you will not repent it, and I will serve you well. You don't know how well. There was a lowering energy in her face as she stood looking at me, while I explained the impossibility of my angering her without thinking it necessary to say how very little I desired to do so, which seemed to bring visibly before me some woman from the streets of Paris in the Reign of Terror. She heard me out without interruption, and then said with her pretty accent and in her mildest voice, "Hey, mademoiselle, I have received my answer. I am sorry of it. But I must go elsewhere, and seek what I have not found here. Will you graciously let me kiss your hand?" She looked at me more intently as she took it, and seemed to take note, with her momentary touch, of every vein in it. "I fear I surprised you, mademoiselle, on the day of the storm," she said with a parting curtsy. I confessed that she had surprised us all. "I took an oath, mademoiselle," she said, smiling, "and I wanted to stamp it on my mind, so that I might keep it faithfully. And I will. Adieu, mademoiselle." So ended our conference, which I was very glad to bring to a close. I supposed she went away from the village, for I saw her no more, and nothing else occurred to disturb our tranquil summer pleasures until 6 weeks were out, and we returned home as I began just now by saying. At that time, and for a good many weeks after that time, Richard was constant in his visits. Besides coming every Saturday or Sunday and remaining with us until Monday morning, he sometimes rode out on horseback unexpectedly, and passed the evening with us, and rode back again early next day. He was as vivacious as ever, and told us he was very industrious, but I was not easy in my mind about him. It appeared to me that his industry was all misdirected. I could not find that it led to anything but the formation of delusive hopes in connection with the suit already the pernicious cause of so much sorrow and ruin. He had got at the core of that mystery now, he told us, and nothing could be plainer than that the will under which he and Otto were to take I don't know how many thousands of pounds must be finally established, if there were any sense or justice in the court of Chancery. But oh, what a great, if that sounded in my ears, and that this happy conclusion could not be much longer delayed. He proved this to himself by all the weary arguments on that side he had read, and every one of them sunk him deeper in the infatuation. He had even begun to haunt the court. He told us how he saw Miss Flight there daily, how they talked together, and how he did her little kindnesses, and how, while he laughed at her, he pitied her from his heart. But he never thought, never, my poor, dear, sanguine Richard, capable of so much happiness then, and with such better things before him, what a fatal link was riveting between his fresh youth and her faded age, between his free hopes and her caged birds, and her hungry garret, and her wandering mind. Ada loved him too well to mistrust him much in anything he said or did, and my guardian, though he frequently complained of the east wind, and read more than usual in the growlery, preserved a strict silence on the subject. So I thought one day, when I went to London to meet Caddy Jellyby, at her solicitation, I would ask Richard to be in waiting for me at the coach office, that we might have a little talk together. I found him there when I arrived, and we walked away arm in arm. "Well, Richard," said I as soon as I could begin to be grave with him, "are you beginning to feel more settled now?" "Oh, yes, my dear," returned Richard. "I'm all right enough."
"But settled?" said one.
"How do you mean, settled?" returned Richard with his gay laugh.
"Settled in the law," said one.
"Oh, I," replied Richard, "I'm all right enough. You said that before, my dear Richard.
And you don't think it's an answer, eh?
Well, perhaps it's not."
"Settled? You mean, do I feel as if I were settling down?"
"Yes."
Why, no, I can't say I am settling down, said Richard, strongly emphasizing down, as if that expressed the difficulty, because one can't settle down while this business remains in such an unsettled state. When I say this business, of course I mean the forbidden subject. Do you think it will ever be in a settled state? Said one. Not the least doubt of it, answered Richard. We walked a little way without speaking, and presently Richard addressed me in his frankest and most feeling manner, thus. My dear Esther, I understand you, and I wish to heaven I were a more constant sort of fellow. I don't mean constant to Ada, for I love her dearly better and better every day, but constant to myself. Somehow, I mean something that I can't very well express, but you'll make it out. If I were a more constant sort of fellow, I should have held on either to Badger or to Kenjan Carboy like Grim Death, and should have begun to be steady and systematic by this time, and shouldn't be in debt, and are you in debt, Richard? Yes, said Richard, I am a little so, my dear. Also, I have taken rather too much to billiards and that sort of thing. Now the murder's out. You despise me, Esther, don't you? You know I don't, said one. You are kinder to me than I often am to myself, he returned. My dear Esther, I am a very unfortunate dog, not to be more settled, but how can I be more settled? If you lived in an unfinished house, you couldn't settle down in it. If you were condemned to leave everything you undertook unfinished, you would find it hard to apply yourself to anything. And yet that's my unhappy case. I was born into this unfinished contention with all its chances and changes, and it began to unsettle me before I quite knew the difference between a suit at law and a suit of clothes, and it has gone on unsettling me ever since, and here I am now, conscious sometimes that I am but a worthless fellow, to love my confiding cousin Ada. We were in a solitary place, and he put his hands before his eyes, and sobbed as he said the words. Oh, Richard, said one, do not be so moved. You have a noble nature, and Ada's love may make you worthier every day. I know, my dear, he replied, pressing my arm, I know all that. You mustn't mind my being a little soft now, for I have had all this upon my mind for a long time, and have often meant to speak to you, and have sometimes wanted opportunity and sometimes courage. I know what the thought of Ada ought to do for me, but it doesn't do it. I am too unsettled even for that. I love her most devotedly, and yet I do her wrong, in doing myself wrong, every day and hour. But it can't last forever. We shall come on for a final hearing, and get judgment in our favor, and then you and Ada shall see what I can really be. It had given me a pang to hear him sob, and see the tears start out between his fingers, but that was infinitely less affecting to me than the hopeful animation with which he said these words. I have looked well into the papers, Esther. I have been deep in them for months, he continued, recovering his cheerfulness in a moment, and you may rely upon it that we shall come out triumphant. As to years of delay, there has been no want of them, heaven knows. And there is the greater probability of our bringing the matter to a speedy close. In fact, it's on the paper now. It will be all right at last, and then you shall see. Recalling how he had just now placed Messrs. Kenjan Carboy in the same category with Mr. Badger, I asked him when he intended to be articled in Lincoln's Inn. There again. I think not at all, Esther, he returned with an effort. I fancy I have had enough of it. Having worked at Jarndyce and Jarndyce like a galley slave, I have slaked my thirst for the law, and satisfied myself that I shouldn't like it. Besides, I find it unsettles me more and more to be so constantly upon the scene of action. So what, continued Richard, confident again by this time, do I naturally turn my thoughts to? I can't imagine, said one. Don't look so serious, returned Richard, because it's the best thing I can do, my dear Esther, I am certain. It's not as if I wanted a profession for life. These proceedings will come to a termination, and then I am provided for. No, I look upon it as a pursuit which is in its nature more or less unsettled, and therefore suited to my temporary condition, I may say, precisely suited. What is it that I naturally turn my thoughts to? I looked at him, and shook my head. What, said Richard, in a tone of perfect conviction, but the army?
The army?
Said one. The army, of course. What I have to do, is to get a commission, and there I am, you know, said Richard. And then he showed me, proved by elaborate calculations in his pocketbook, that supposing he had contracted, say, £200 of debt in 6 months out of the army, and that he contracted no debt at all within a corresponding period in the army, as to which he had quite made up his mind, this step must involve a saving of £400 in a year, or £2,000 in 5 years, which was a considerable sum. And then he spoke so ingenuously and sincerely of the sacrifice he made in withdrawing himself for a time from Ada, and of the earnestness with which he aspired, as in thought he always did, I know full well, to repay her love, and to ensure her happiness, and to conquer what was amiss in himself, and to acquire the very soul of decision, that he made my heart ache keenly, sorely. For, I thought, how would this end, how could this end, when so soon and so surely all his manly qualities were touched by the fatal blight? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.